Hello, this is Kyle Jones. For this lecture, I have been asked by one of my students to explain once again the concept of time within chronological and non-chronological biblical timetables. I find it perplexing as how, in the recorded historical sense, one should start the topic of time. For time is a broad subject. Time exists everywhere and every when. Though every when is not a word, I hope you get my point. Concerning this particular lecture, I felt that I had somewhat of an advantage, or several advantages, to this study. Three of them I will mention. The first is that I am a tabla player. That is, I have studied rhythmic principles on an East Indian instrument that has its history as far back as recorded history can take us. Tabla forces one to feel many types of times, all within the same context of performance. The second advantage that I feel that I have is that my wife is Chinese while I am an American. I have experienced discussions go bad in times past with us mainly due to the differences of our mental framework, which can predispose our discussions of time into a very different orientation. That is, where I, as a Westerner, wanted a reeled-out dialogue, my wife throws out frames of thought that do not necessarily have to be in the ordered sense of a Westerner's view of mental sequencing or mental time. Such non-Western views of time fall under a lecture that I have recently presented called Pictographic Societies. Relating to this mental framework, Dr. Worf has done an excellent treatment on the Hopi Indians who have much in common with this same type of mental framing within their thought processing. The third advantage I have to this treatment of biblical time is that I have been a stutterer all of my life who has to deal with an innate desire to express all of my thoughts at once. If you will, a sense of immediacy. For me, time always got in the way and created a turbulence of word clustering. That is, I did not like Western word sequencing and its delaying of time, for the emotional effect of speech was somehow lost for me in word sequencing. Well, looking back with pitied laughter, I was incapable of expressing even my frustrations correctly because I was too busy stuttering. It has only been fairly recently that I have come to understand the importance of ordered speech within an ordered dialogue. I have begun to realize how much logos as idea, deity, and a theological rule of thumb means to me. Moreover, it has been this affliction / blessing of stuttering that has made me see the value of my wife as a Chinese thinker, let alone her as my beloved spouse. With all that said, it is logos, or ordered speech, that does not allow for my stuttering, though when I am not in logos, I will stutter. Time, immediacy, sequencing, geometrical or frame thought, and marriage for sure all have a composite notion for me. Anyway, I hope to draw on my experiences and knowledge for you in order to lay out a more complete view of biblical time and the dynamism between God and man. It seemed for me that one of the strongest arguments for theological time was laid out by two strong and opposing thinkers within the 3rd and 4th centuries AD. So I decided to start with the treatment that Origen had laid out in his Periarchon. I also approached Augustine in his City of God, which at certain places had concerned itself with the prevailing ideas of Origen. Augustine's argument, most people say Augustine because of the of the place where we go to vacate, but it is Augustine. Augustine's argument against Origen's prevalent theological ideas used the same general terminologies that Origen did for time as concepts, but with a completely different dynamism, which I shall explain in this lecture. The ingeniousness of Augustine's argument against Origen's prevailing ideas sparked me to follow through with an answer to my student concerning the concept of biblical time. It might be at first an odd approach to use Origen and Augustine to define sorts of timetables until we begin to realize that it is a biblical or at least theological concept of time that we are addressing, and not always a chronological sense of time. It is within these theological concepts of time that was drawn upon by these great scholars that we may now address the dilemma of eternity, time, free will, and predeterminism, or, if possible, the synthesis of these factors. I do not hold to Origen or Augustine or Augustine's view in their entirety. Many limitations were set on their range of thought, though the sources they extrapolated from were far-reaching. With that said, I find that Origen and Augustine caught the afterburner of some of the greatest ideas that the first century had developed. Especially with the advent of New Testament Christianity and its concurrent Greek paideia, which is the instruction to the young all the way to the old. But with this said, there were also many incredible concepts of time, God, dynamism, etc., taking place in the Far East and early Americas that had already existed in a distant past. Such early Proto-American cultures as the Olmec and Mayan had already synthesized time, eternity, and being as a reality over 1,000 years prior to Augustine and Origen. Such ideas as psychological time, produced by the Olmecs, Mayans, and Hopis, I hope to address in the process of these lectures. Well, let's begin. Origen said in his work, called the Periarchon, that there are no Christian values in the Old Testament. Origen seemed to have been heavily influenced by doctrines which saw that the Old Testament was only laden with stories of incest, murder, prostitution, thievery, etc., by the original patriarchs of the Old Testament. Therefore, Origen had nothing to do with the Old Testament. One of Origen's influences seems to have been Manichaeism. Such a quote from a leading Manichaean was that of Faustus. Faustus said that we Manichaeans do not include the writings about Abraham's attempted child sacrifice and selling of Sarah into prostitution, which is his wife, for our religious edification. Nor do we include the selling of one's wife into prostitution as a precept for living. We Manichaeans believe that the Jews were a bloodthirsty, incestuous, debaucherous group of people. We Manichaeans, as Faustus proclaimed, are indeed enemies of the Judaistic God. It was around the time of Origen's exile from Alexandria that Origen had traveled to Rome, encountering en route such wandering scholars as the Manichaeans. Such influences as the Manichaeans can be seen in Origen's work called the Periarchon. Such a view goes as follows, quote, "All souls possess a divine attributive nature called free will, which is at least capable of returning the soul back to its original state of sanctification." Such an idea is still prevalent amongst many Christian denominations as we have today. Due to this belief, Origen said that all souls therefore possess the free will to return to a sanctified state. Because of this grant of right of free will as divine attribute in the souls of all men, the Old Testament, therefore, is at best nothing more than an indictment against the Jews, as Origen said, and is simply a tribal cult story of failed attempts to act upon Yahweh's virtue of free will. And therefore, the Old Testament, as a moral instruction book, is not a necessary tool for reproof and correction within the writings of the Christian apologists. Nonetheless, Origen believed in his universalism and said that the Jews will still be saved under God's, quote, all-encompassing efficacious grace. Keep in mind, once again, this is what Origen was thinking. This is not in any way representative of how I think or anybody that is affiliated with this lecture thinks. Okay, let's continue here. In brief, Origen established in his theology that, number one, everything that is with body is not God. Number two, rational being is a being with free choice. Number three, man is in the state of individuation and alteration, which is separate from God, for he is eternally one and unalterable. Number four, man had no choice while under judgment of God during their separation from God. Number five, God, being unalterable, established the alterations or ambiguations in man, in that man, through the attributes of God's virtues, which is free will, will understand his nature of sin. That is, free will is the necessary tool to see God's virtue by exercising rational free choice, and thereby overcoming the fallen state of alteration and sin. Number six, all of creation as a judgment is the result of the eternal falling into its correct vibration. Therefore, all of creation deals with its level or position of judgment that it may learn. Free will is the godly virtue that will be the key for man in his fall to learn from his position of fall by what vibration or frequency he has fallen to. Such virtuous free will agents are man, animal, plants, stars, moons, and rocks. The literal or instructional sense of the body of Scripture is for the basic fallen man, and the spiritual or higher level of reading is for the spiritual man. Number eight, chronological time mattered because it was created due to sin in order that free will could exercise itself for what it was, a godly attribute, as we have said before, and therefore work with and through time to show the extension of God within time, and finally to show that it could sanctify the one who was practicing free will, for godly free will was the free thing that was from alteration and sin. Once again, this is to reestablish something, the step number eight, that we are to see God's extension in time through this. Okay, number nine, therefore every single layer of the cosmos is positioned for a lesson to freely love God again, as it used to. Number 10, ultimately the universe goes back to God. Number 11, it is only within the, quote, erotic component of knowledge, end quote, which will finally go back to nihil, or go to nihil, or nothingness. Origen had, of course, created more mentions to his theology than this, but we can see that Origen's theology was an attempt to justify free will as a synchronized reality within the eternal God and time-oriented man. Within Origen's attempt to systematize free will and universal grace, free will was not really contingent upon one's salvation, mainly due to all of creation has having been co-eternative with God. Therefore, creation will simply return to where it fell from. Therefore, two main ideas became prevalent from Origen's work. One of them was the style of Christian fatalism, that is, no matter what you do, you will ultimately be saved. Now, such a view is at first hard to distinguish from what Christian predeterminism is. The other theological idea that came prevalent from Origen's premises was a return to a, quote, works-based religion, where it is up to the individual to, quote, get it together with God through the divine virtue of free will that mankind could employ. It was Augustine who took the Pauline predeterminism to its task in order that he may answer to the ideas of Origen's free will doctrine and universalistic salvation. Augustine said that man was created once, and it was in time. Augustine continued to say, no creature is co-eternal with God, and no human being preceded Adam. Augustine said The body is not a temporary accident where the soul has been dipped from an eternal state. The flesh and the soul are both in agreement, as is a fetus, which is a combination of body, soul, and spirit. Augustine said that, with implication to Origen's use of the term universalism, that universalism is damnation. Augustine meant that, quote, all have been born under the flesh, and since the flesh is corrupt, limited, fallible, made to die, made to sin by its impulse. Augustine's view, therefore, holds as follows. If universalism, from Origen's sense of the word, universalism, was a reality, it would justly be applied as a damnable device rather than a saving device. For mankind is in a state of fallenness, and the universal status for mankind is damnable. Therefore, the opposite of just is arbitrariness, not grace. And justice would be that of all of mankind that would be damned. Augustine said, a, quote, just God is not dualistic in his mode of salvation and sanctification. Augustine said, in rebuttal to Origen's idea of anti-legalism, quote, either God is just or he is ambiguous in his decisions. Augustine furthered this and said that grace is something else other than the antonym of just or legally right. This becomes the argument against Manichaeanism's polemic against the Jews' God of justice and blood sacrifice. Augustine's view was that the patriarchal Jew was not in opposition to grace, but rather they were sketches of why grace is needed and what grace really is, not something that is opposite to justice. Augustine believed that grace is what is needed to save fallen man who cannot stop sinning. For man's natural state cannot choose God. Man cannot regenerate himself, for he is fallen. Therefore, he naturally will not employ free will as a godly virtue. Therefore, the opposites, if any, are to be shown in man's nature versus God's, not in the distinguishable attributes of God's justice, grace, and his free will. Augustine continued to distinguish and separate God's status from man by saying that, quote, a holy and eternal God does nothing outside of us that moves on us to sin. Rather, it is we that we cannot refuse to sin, for sin is unimpeded in our fallen state. Again, to Augustine, God is too holy to be in the flesh to motivate the flesh. Therefore, humanity, if any portion is to be saved, is the object of redemption, which is a holy act and not a humanistic willful act. That is, man receives the verbal action from a dynamically moving holy God. God is the verb, we are the noun or object. He is alive and we are dead in our sins. Therefore, a dead man cannot make a living decision. And therefore, our repentance operates as follows. It is the verbal God who rushes upon us and makes us act righteously. Therefore, we are the objects of redemptive grace, as we have said, by the outside source. And finally, we therefore cannot of and by ourselves employ humanistic free will, as we have said before, to get us to salvation, sanctification, or reason to God. For it is by God alone that he operates in his free will, giving us freely our salvation and reason and thought. Again, I will state that Augustine states that humanistic free will does quite the opposite from the free will of God. In Augustine's Confessions, he made the point that time does not affect God's word, for sovereign God spoke and creation was. Augustine said that God is in eternity. Therefore, his words, his judgments, his decisions are immediate. For Augustine, this is quite opposite to fallen man, where he uses time sequencing to speak, to decide, to act, etc. It is our actions that are under time, therefore limited to God's conditioning of time, and the spatial dynamics that act within time's conditions. Augustine viewed the Jews as a pattern within sequencing of time. That is, instead of a wasteful, debaucherous clan, not worthy of being recognized, Augustine viewed that the Jews were a necessary connection to the Christian body, by way of sketch, pattern, and design of the Christ and his patterning. Augustine viewed biblical history, or biblical time, as a device for us to collect the fuller sense of the eternal, starting with Genesis 1 and following. Such stories as that of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, animal sacrificing, prophets performing portentous pantomiming, and therefore, and all the rest, foreshadows a future light that Christ would show to us, rather than a Faustinian deplorable act. The events of the Old Testament were time slices to Augustine. Augustine stated that reality is all of time reeled out. One time slice needs the other in order to reel out the complete statement, and that God cannot contradict himself within his word to us because of his singularity or holiness of thought that holds even eternity together. Therefore, God's Bible, Old and New Testament, are contained without contradiction, though reeled out over millennia. The eternal singleness of God's thought is the congruent factoring in his holy words that distend into our time. It is therefore eternity extended through ordered logos. Much more did Augustine say that I do not have time to elaborate on concerning time and dynamism. Such statements from Origen and Augustine should start a firestorm of thought for any who are listening. It is Origen and Augustine's approach to time that has drawn me in to attempt part of the answer for my student. This is a lengthy study, and I do not plan on one lecture doing this treatment justice. It is not just with the Jewish or Christian mind that I turn my attention to concerning deity, time, dynamism, free will, and predeterminism. I am most impressed with the honesty of true paganism that I find out so much about the Christianity that I believe in. It is for the honesty of the true pagan that I am in much debt to for my understanding. If I can for a moment, please allow me to explain myself in brief for using the term pagan. I do not use pagan as term as a moral indicator. I take the use of pagan from its original sense. The Latin term pagan comes from the word paganus, which means country dweller. For me, no one has ever explained the pagan or heathen more correctly than that of our professor J.R.R. Tolkien. And his influence on me pushed my study of how pagan should be defined in the context of what the Anglo-Saxons would call lough and dome, and paganus. The Anglo-Saxon lough, where we get our word lofty, meant the hierarchy, especially that of the house lord, who ruled by his creed and standard. His dome, or dominion, was his home where the rules of domesticity centered. From there, the levels of dominion decreased, such as that of the villains or villagers who lived outside the household, in their farmhouses within the grounds of the lord's ownership. That is, the grounds were still under the lord's dominion. Though villain was not necessarily a bad name, it was just one who was notably farther away from the house and its house laws than those who dwelt with the lord of the domain and were more in accord with the house law, such as the lord's children, Frau Priya, which is the wife, or endeared wife. From there we get our Hathen, or heathen, or country dweller, who was even more outside the parameters of the villains or villagers. Again, not a moral term, but a placement term from the position of those who dwelt in the house with their lord and/or master. This is technically, for now, how I use the word pagan or heathen. With that said, I journey from my home to the distant pagan world in order that I may, once again, return home for a fuller and more balanced understanding of the Christian God that I attempt to serve. Before I start with the major concepts of time within the Jewish and pagan world, I thought I would give you an example of the dynamic mind of the Greek in contrast to that of the ancient Jew. For it is in this style of dynamism that time is sensed by the Greek and much of the pagan world. W.F. Otto said, quote, "It was the ancient Greeks' artificiality that conveyed the image of the psychological god or gods whom they wished to express their accord with. Artificial, in this sense, just means made by humans as a lesser image than the real thing. As Dr. Lipton calls the plurality of dancers, the float, it is in the float of dancers that movement or verbal action is observed as deity within the Greek rites. The physical aspect of the dance and all of its decorum is called the plasein or the mold, by which the deity is to share. The Greek word used to convey such a complex idea as sharing from the deity to the substance was called metike, or sharing of the substance. This is to be distinguished from that of transubstantiation, where one thing becomes another. With that said, the seeming irrationality of the Greeks held that the, quote, "The sooner you rid yourselves of the questioning of external visibilities of the circular dances, choreographs, dramas, etc., the sooner the image of the one invisible God with personal reality can be faced freely." Such an idea was agreed upon by Plato in his idea that all of physical reality is nothing more than a lesser reality of the eternity. Plato continued to say that, quote, "physical reality as a receptacle of the eternal only fails in its attempts to contain the eternal." Plato therefore diminished the importance of a personal God in order that the idea of God may be shown. Plato believed that personification of a deity would all too readily give the intuitiveness of the psychological concept of person, which is itself incapable of representing God logically or graphically. Visual representation of the Greek gods was sometimes called icon. Icon was understood as something that the deity and the worshiper yielded to. The icon meant, in plain words to the ancient Greeks, as the, quote, "coming into appearance of the kernel, the essence of the thing." It, that is, the deity, participates in reality. Christ was called the icon in Colossians 1, chapter 1, verse 15, as we see in its Greek, icon tu theotu aoratu, or in the English, as the Christ who is the icon or image of the invisible God. Very similar in nature, the pagan Greek saw the deity as the verbal act and the sharer of the substances, such as the decorum, tassels, masks, initiates, even the inhabiting of the pharmakon or the sibyl, etc. It is interesting that the Greeks understood that the artificiality or plasticness of their substances in their deity worship were used to share with the god. and by this standard of invocation, worship is able to delineate the natural from the divine. While the plastic or artificiality of the Jewish temple was obediently placed in order so that the deity would fill his train in the Naas or high temple of the Jew, as we find in Isaiah chapter 6 verse 1, to give order to the sins of the believing Jew. And their atonement. Such closer parallels, though, could be drawn for sure, but for a lack of time, I must enter into the field of time here. In contrast to the Greek, the Jews' form of thinking is expressed in the Hebrew language as moving in time, whereas the Greek uses space as the form for which thought can occur. Line, as space is concerned, is an example of popular Greek and modern Western thought, as seen in our concept of rectilinear thinking. Aristotle, though, conceived spatial time as cyclical due to the consistency of cycles within planetary movement and the belief of the sun's movement around the earth. Therefore, a line was a way to measure the chronology of cyclical movement. A larger idea of time might be found in Greek chronometry, which was thought of as the uniformity of all circles. Therefore, Aristotle took heed to this idea and defined chronological time as the, quote, continuous dimension of successive movement, or the dimension of succession. The Greek idea of chronological time was seen as inferior to space and was hinted at by the Greeks as being evil. Aristotle believed that time destroys, kata te ke ho chronos. It is interesting that we see Chronos, the Greek god, as the horned one. Father Time was with his horns. And it is from here that we find horn and chronos linguistically related. Aristotle continued to say that all things grow old under the pressure of chronos, or time, and are forgotten. Nothing grows new in time, and through time's durée, or duration, nothing grows beautiful. Therefore, the Greeks looked at time as destructive and not constructive. It was out of this thinking that, by elimination of time itself, in thought that is, space became holy. Geometry, therefore, was a study of the holy and eternal, because space and the reality of geometry, without the effects of time, were without change and transitoriness. Hence, time, change, and transitoriness were considered to be synonymous. Dr. Von Orelli made it clear how useless our Western concept of time is when he charged the Western mind with the fault of thinking that chronological time is epistemological time. Ironically, we should look back to our Greek friend Aristotle for the meaning of Father Chronos again. Nonetheless, Dr. Orelli said that for the Jews, time must be self-evident and must be established as a scheme of thought or a categorical form in order to have a standard by which the Israelite conception of time can be measured and evaluated. With this said, von Orelli goes on to say that, quote, motion must be in contiguous relation with that of time, end quote. And no matter how different the philosophical schemes are between the Hebrew and European mind, the idea of motion and time are always co-relational. Such notions of this contiguous relation of time and motion might be found within the Hebrew and European minds as follows. Before and behind are the same as the future and the past, but the dynamic understanding between that of the Hebrew and European are quite different. For the ancient European thought of the future as that which lies before us, while the ancient Hebrew mind looked at the future events as coming after us, or that future time chases us. This view of future time, therefore, centered the Hebrew as the point in which time dynamically focused itself as a movement towards, whereas the European passes marks on the chronological timeline, the Hebrew stayed fixed as motion moved upon him. It is in this Hebrew concept of time that shows time to the Hebrew as a congruently whole and moving thing. Both the ancient Greek, ancient Hebrew, and modern European think in terms of time as aided with that of sun, moon, and stars. But with that said, very different interpretations are made concerning these. The Greeks looked at the heavenly bodies as spherical, therefore geometrical, therefore attributive to holiness. The Greeks also observed where the heavenlies were. This is also a geometrical property. So, positioning and spatial configurations were part of the Greeks' view of the heavenlies and where they were positioned in alignment of the heavenlies. It is in this way that the Greeks positioned themselves to time. This is a wholly different view than that of the ancient Hebrew who saw day and night as light and dark. These properties were separate and distinct. As God created the light, he saw that it was good and separated it from the darkness. From this point, we can see reference to good and evil as found in the oldest book of the Bible, which is in Job chapter 30, verse 26, stating, "When I looked for good, evil came. And when I waited for light, darkness came." Light is also an attributive property to God, as God is referred to as David's light and salvation in Psalms chapter 27, verse 1. Well, for the sake of time, I must end at this point. Next week, I hope to continue within the first hour of our lecture with the book of John and the second hour with our continued study concerning biblical time. If you would like to contact me, you can do so at my email address, kylejones37075@yahoo.com. Until next time, God bless. This is Kyle Jones.